This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. Bond Huberman is joining me live, tweeting at KUOW. Seahawks wide receiver Doug Baldwin was in the news again today. He was in Olympia, testifying in front of a legislative task force. Its members are looking at the state law that deals with police officers who are involved in deadly shootings. Officers can be prosecuted only if they act with malice and with a lack of good faith. Baldwin's father was a police officer, but he says the law should be changed.
Law enforcement agencies want to serve their communities. They want to serve them with the best trained officers. They want to serve them with the most useful resources to make their community safer. And the communities want the same thing. And if this is truly what is desired by both sides, then removing malice from the statute and at least further defining what good faith means as an objective standard is not only the logical thing to do, it's the right thing to do.
The future of this law is now being debated in the legislature and is also the subject of a citizens' initiative. We have both sides of that debate. First, Jeff Robinson is an attorney in Seattle and deputy legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union. He says the law unfairly shields police from prosecution.
The shooting that we all saw in Oklahoma, where the man was shot by a woman, a female police officer, killed with his hands up, standing outside the car. In the state of Washington, that officer would not be successfully prosecuted because there is no proof of malice or evil intent or lack of good faith on the part of that officer. She said, "I was scared. I panicked. I'm really, really sorry." And so one of the questions is, it's a very simple question. Do you want police to be able to shoot and kill people in the state of Washington under circumstances that we saw on that videotape? That officer would not be charged in the state of Washington. And if charged, it would be virtually impossible to convict. And these aren't just my words. These are, you know, there are prosecutors across the state who acknowledge this. And so the question is, what kind of message are you sending to communities? This is not about police officers having dangerous jobs or being heroes. This is about, in the state of Washington, a police officer can legally kill someone. And when I say legally, I mean avoid criminal prosecution if the killing is reckless, and I'm not using that term to be provocative, reckless as defined by the law in the state of Washington. If it is negligent, if it is unjustified, and if it is unnecessary, as defined by the law in the state of Washington. And so what message does that send to people in the community that these are the circumstances under which police can kill you without any accountability?
You argue that Washington State is unique in the nation in terms of having this very high bar to prosecute police officers. How did this law come to be? What's the history here? How did this language get into the law?
It's a very convoluted history, and quite frankly, the explanations that I have heard really don't make sense. And so I think what is less important is how this got into the law. What's more important is, what do we do about it now? Now that we recognize no one who is in the state legislature today was responsible for writing this law. And so how it got in and why it got in, it seems to me, is of little import when we see the result of this law, which is, and I'm not saying anyone intended it to be this way, but in terms of the operation of this law in the state of Washington, it's a license to kill.
Is the purpose of changing the law to give prosecutors a greater ability to prosecute more police officers?
Quite frankly, my view of the purpose in changing the law is to send an absolute and clear message to the community that police officers who act outside the bounds of appropriate behavior will be held accountable. If more police officers are prosecuted, then that's the result of the law. But as I've said, you can look at the laws in the other 49 states and look at the results in the other 49 states. You're not seeing a huge number of prosecutions in those states as compared to the state of Washington. So this is less about prosecuting individual police officers, in my view, and more about changing the law so that you are saying to communities who have historically been the subject of unnecessary violence by the police, and I think we are all at a point where we will recognize that that's true, saying to those communities, we are going to write a law that at least holds officers accountable if they act outside the bounds of what we as the community deem to be appropriate behavior. And so if more police officers are prosecuted, that's fine. But at least the standards by which we judge them will be standards that show respect for the community that they're supposed to protect and serve.
And what do you say to those police officers who worry that changing the law will have a chilling effect on police officers?
Look at the statistics. There is no identifiable change in the rate of police officers being prosecuted in the other 49 states. And I also say this. Here is the law that would apply to police officers in the state of Washington if you got rid of malice and good faith. If a police officer uses deadly force and that police officer is reasonable as defined by a reasonable person standard, knowing what that officer knew and seeing what that officer saw, but having an objective overlay of reasonableness, then the officer isn't going to be held responsible for killing somebody. If the officer makes a mistake, as long as the mistake is reasonable, the officer won't be held responsible for killing anybody. So why does a police officer need more protection than this? Go out and do your job. Use deadly force if you think it is absolutely necessary and the only resort.
That was Jeff Robinson from the American Civil Liberties Union. Now we turn to what police think of this potential change. Craig Bulkley is president of the Washington Council of Police and Sheriffs. He's also a police officer in Spokane. He told me there's no evidence that police officers are hiding behind the word malice.
I think that the prosecutors have the ability to file charges on police officers if it's warranted. I'm not sure why our prosecutors are not filing charges. I believe that's on our county prosecutors to file those charges if there are cases. And I'm not sure why it would be that difficult if there was such a use of without malice on somebody. I'm just not sure why our prosecutors wouldn't file charges.
We've certainly heard from prosecutors, for example, with the killing of John T. Williams, the Indian woodcarver who was shot in Seattle. And I believe at that point, Dan Satterberg, the prosecutor here, said there was no point moving forward with a prosecution because it was really difficult to prove malice in that situation. What's your reaction to that?
Again, if we start going through each case, I'm not familiar enough with that case to actually to give you my opinion on it. I trust in the prosecutors. I trust that if they believe that there wasn't enough to charge an individual, then that's what their gut feeling is. And as you know, even if our prosecutor fails to, if there is evidence there, even if our prosecutor fails, there is a federal statute. I know there is a police officer that was in Spokane that spent time in jail because our local prosecutor failed to prosecute, but the federal government did.
I want to ask you about some of the emotions around this because it is very emotional. And you are a police officer in Spokane. What does this feel like to be having this conversation and this debate right now for police? I mean, what impact is this having on officers?
Well, I can tell you that it is the all of a sudden we are the villains. Police officers are the bad guys here. I'm having conversations with several groups across the state talking about this, and the bottom line is it would be an olive branch if you did this. And you know, my members, the police officers across the state, are like an olive branch. I'm not sure what that means as far as they're doing their jobs. But one of the things it's done, to answer your question, Deb, is that it has put us on the defensive, like we are the bad guys now. We have done something wrong, and we have nothing that shows that our law enforcement officers are doing anything wrong. If there are incidents out there where they need to be held accountable for it, I don't want to work with a bad cop. But on the other hand, changing it just for the sake of changing it, as it's been stated before, I'm not sure that changing this is actually going to reduce the number of violent encounters with law enforcement in the community. I just don't know how this is going to affect that.
Do you have another idea for how to reduce the number of violent encounters with police that doesn't involve changing the law? Do you have other things that you'd rather see put into place?
Yes, we do. And we've submitted those to the task force. You know, some of the things that we've talked about is the mental health issue. That is huge across the country, let alone in our state. But that is something that needs to be dealt with. You have police officers out there on the street playing mental health counselors because the mental health profession can't keep up. That is one of the things that we have to have, is maybe going side by side with mental health. I know in Spokane County that is something that's being done, a partnership between law enforcement and the mental health professionals. And that's something I think we have to look at, seeing what we can do. The less lethal piece, you know, training our officers to use less lethal when it's appropriate. What we need to do is have those tools available to all the agencies, all the officers in the state. Believe it or not, we have agencies in the state that don't have those lethal tools available, and that's something that we have to have.
Well, the task force that's meeting in Olympia now will be making some kind of recommendations to the legislature about this law, and there's also an initiative out there that's gathering signatures that could do the same thing. Given that there is this threat of an initiative, of a citizens' initiative, do you support making some changes to the state law now? I mean, something?
You know, I think that I've said this organization has said this long, police officers across the state have said, if we need to educate people, we'll do that, but I'm not sure that the change of a law merely to make somebody feel better is going to do any good. I just don't think that. I think communication between law enforcement and the community will do by far more than changing without malice. I'm not sure that that's going to change a thing.
That was Craig Bulkley, president of the Washington Council of Police and Sheriffs. A state task force is meeting right now in Olympia to discuss how the state should rewrite laws that protect police officers involved in shootings. The task force is expected to present its recommendations later this afternoon. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. If you look at the map of how people voted in this presidential election, Washington State has big swaths of red and then clusters of bright blue. Geographically, most of the state voted for Donald Trump, but the biggest population centers, around Seattle, voted solidly for Hillary Clinton. But south of Tacoma, there are purple areas, Clinton and Trump voters living side by side. Residents say politics there tend to be more discreet to avoid ruffling feathers, and being a Democrat means something very different than it does in Seattle. KUOW's Amy Radel has that story.
Suburban Tacoma is that rare spot where electoral colors mix. Hillary Clinton got 55% of the vote here in the 29th Legislative District. Voters also sent Democrats to the state legislature, but Donald Trump prevailed in six of those precincts.
How I voted? Yeah, I voted for Donald Trump.
Dave Peluso runs a bar in the small business district across I-5 from the Tacoma Mall. He says he vacillated between Trump and Clinton. He didn't really feel like it mattered. He says he's more concerned with local issues like paying the new minimum wage.
You know, if you provide jobs for people, you should have some kind of tax break. The small business is supposed to be the backbone of the economy. But believe me, I feel my backbone's been broken.
Nearby is the Union Hall for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 76. Tim O'Donnell is the union's business manager. He thinks Democrats or independents here who voted for Trump were misled.
I think they had the wrong idea of what he is going to do for the working person. I feel the attacks are coming against labor as soon as the new Congress convenes at the start of January.
Right now, O'Donnell says work is pretty abundant for his members in construction on Joint Base Lewis-McChord and at the Port of Tacoma. But O'Donnell says there's a strong anti-tax feeling in this area that could have fueled Trump support. He says even construction workers he spoke to were concerned about the tax increase in Sound Transit 3, although it could give them jobs for life.
So somebody starting their apprenticeship now could possibly retire off of that project.
That measure failed in Pierce County, but got enough votes in King and Snohomish counties to pass anyway. Democrat Steve Kirby isn't surprised that the transit measure was unpopular here. He's the longtime state representative of the 29th Legislative District.
It's not a place where you want to be in favor of raising taxes, for example.
We're standing by the lake in Wapato Park. His district shoots out of South Tacoma and winds around Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Over time, it's been redrawn to include more suburban and Republican-leaning voters.
Most of whom hadn't voted for a Democrat, like, ever. I don't know.
So he's proud of getting reelected this year with 60% of the vote. Kirby says he does that by staying attuned to local needs and departing from his caucus when necessary.
And remember, my caucus is dominated by Democrats from Seattle who are a little to the left of me. A lot to the left of me.
Yet the district remains Democratic, so Trump voters have taken some of their friends by surprise. Latasha Cooks is a student at Clover Park Technical College. Cooks wasn't passionate about any presidential candidate. Some of her friends seemed uncommitted as well, but then she learned otherwise.
And then when I see their Facebook, then I see it like, oh, okay, I see that you voted for Trump.
Outside, another student, Jacob Oldie, is heading home after class.
I was in the Army for 6 years, and so a lot of my friends, they didn't really want to see Hillary Clinton as president because of certain scandals.
And concerns over gun control. But Oldie says Trump held no appeal for him.
I don't like his stances on global warming. That's personally, to me, that's a huge issue, and he already wants us to get out of the Paris Treaty, just like right off the bat.
He missed voting in the last two presidential elections because of basic training and deployment to Afghanistan. And when the time came...
So here I am, 27 years old, and this is my first time voting. And I was like, oh, geez, there we go. This is awesome. I waited all this time, and these are my choices.
Oldie says he's neutral ground in Purple Pierce County, somewhere between his Army friends who supported Trump and his college friends who rooted for Democrat Bernie Sanders. So who did he vote for? Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
As Amy said, there were parts of Pierce County that supported both Trump and Clinton, which kind of goes against our usual notion of Washington State as divided by the Cascade Curtain, liberals on the west side and conservatives on the east side. Democratic political consultant Ben Anderstone says that's not a really accurate way to look at how people voted this year.
You actually saw a good number of counties in western Washington that voted for Barack Obama last time, especially those more working class counties in southwestern Washington, flipping over to Donald Trump this time. So the traditional view of the western Washington as the liberal stronghold and eastern Washington as the conservative stronghold, I think, is more complicated than people sometimes imagine. It's really, this year was more about the Puget Sound metropolitan area versus some of the more rural and small town parts of the state. And that gap between the metro, the cosmopolitan metro areas, and the more outlying areas really kind of blew up this year more than it ever has in the past.
So we really can't think of the Cascade Curtain anymore, the east-west divide. It's
right.
It's not that black and white
right.
anymore?
In fact, Lewis County in western Washington, which is Centralia and Chehalis, is one of the most conservative counties in Washington state, and swung quite a bit toward Donald Trump. It's another fairly working class area that the Democratic Party over the last few election cycles has really declined in. But this year, the floor dropped out for the Democrats in an area like Lewis County. So Grays Harbor County, which is Hoquiam and Aberdeen out on the Washington coast, an area that's seen a lot of economic difficulty over the last few decades. And this year, for the first time since 1928, Grays Harbor County voted for a Republican candidate for president.
And just because of how the economy is doing there, do you think?
You know, I think a big part of it is that areas like that have had a lot of promises given to them over these decades by politicians, including, to be frank, and I say this as a Democratic consultant, Democratic politicians. And they feel that those haven't really delivered. So they look at a candidate like Donald Trump, who's coming in and say, you know, we're going to kind of blow things up a little bit and start anew. And they've been told for many years that, you know, their house can be repaired, so to speak. And Donald Trump is coming in and saying, let's just knock it down and build it from an empty lot. And I think that that actually has a lot of appeal to these folks who have really not felt as if anybody's delivered for them for a long, long time in Olympia or in Washington, D.C.
And if we look at the metropolitan areas, only 8% of people in Seattle voted for Donald Trump.
This is a record low for the Republicans in Seattle, which you might look at and not take terribly seriously, because, of course, Seattle is a rock-solid Democratic town. But that reflects the decline of the Republican Party among college-educated voters living in metropolitan areas. Laurelhurst, Donald Trump doesn't look like he's going to break 10% in Laurelhurst, which 20, 30 years ago would have been just a nonsensical statement to folks there. And then that also reflects the changes you saw out toward the east side, Bellevue, Redmond. Donald Trump lost up to a third to a quarter of Romney voters in a lot of these more suburban, well-heeled precincts. And that is a problem in Washington state more than a lot of states, because we have quite a few swing voters in those well-heeled suburban precincts. And I think it was actually a bit of a surprise, since Obama was a candidate with some appeal in those areas. I don't think people expected that there could be a floor even further below the levels that Mitt Romney and John McCain had gotten previously, but Donald Trump just absolutely cratered in those areas. Huge, huge portion of why Washington state actually voted more Democratic this time than last.
So pollsters around the country have been under a lot of scrutiny because they got a lot of it wrong on Election Day. How did pollsters here in Seattle do?
So I'll actually be in the awkward position of defending national pollsters here. They hit the popular vote pretty closely. It was really in the Midwest where a lot of the state-level polls were off by a few points. And in cases like Michigan and Wisconsin, that ended up mattering, and it ended up being the difference between a narrow Clinton win and a narrow Trump win. Here in Washington, the polls actually were a little bit off. We're normally a pretty easy state to poll. We normally have pretty accurate polls, but they were actually off in the opposite direction. They underestimated the margin for Hillary Clinton, and that was also true in Oregon and California. It looks like there is some underestimation of the West Coast college-educated urban vote in the polls that you didn't see in those more Rust Belt and Midwestern states.
Could it be that people just don't like to tell the truth to pollsters? People on both sides?
You know, some of it may be that. Another part is it's just tough to figure out who's going to show up in a presidential election. And pollsters have a lot more technical issues. The increase in cell phone only households has been a big problem. It's tougher to get a hold of people. People are busier these days. They're less likely to actually respond to a poll. So there are a bunch of technical factors going on in addition to the kind of the question about whether Trump, you know, made some people nervous about talking about him to pollsters. But I think that it's going to be a lot of factors, and I'm not sure that we'll ever fully understand what happened this year. But again, in defense of the polls, they weren't off terribly compared to historical average. Polls often miss by a little bit. That happened this year. Recent years, we've been lucky. This year, not so much, but that's just kind of how polls work.
Let's talk a little bit about local races, because you and I spoke about a week before the election, and
yes,
you were expecting a pretty substantial down-ballot effect of the Trump candidacy, and you thought local Republicans were going to have a really hard time this year.
Right.
Did that not happen?
It depends what part of the state. Here in King County, I believe it did. You have two districts on the east side. The 41st district, where you saw an incumbent state senator, Steve Litzau, on track to lose by about 4 percentage points. Now, Donald Trump lost that district by about 42 percentage points, which was an increase of about 20 points since 4 years ago. It's really tough to imagine that in that hostile environment for Republicans, that didn't hurt Litzau's standings. Same deal in the 5th district out toward the Cascade foothills, where a incumbent Democratic state senator narrowly held on, and it's kind of hard to imagine that Trump being at the top of the ticket didn't help him do that. However, outside of King County, it looks like Republicans ran well ahead of their numbers in a lot of swing districts. They actually picked up a district out on the Washington coast that's been ancestrally Democratic, but voted for Donald Trump this time, a very working class district. So the results appear to be mixed, but I think the overall theme is that yet again, the state Republican Party managed to outperform by quite a bit the national brand, managed to separate themselves from quite a bit. It wasn't quite enough in those districts where there was just a tidal wave against Donald Trump, but outside of that area, outside of King County, they did, I think, had a pretty solid year, all being said.
Your job is to really understand where voters are, right? And what they're going to do on election day.
Right.
How hard is it to do your job right now? I mean, given how divided people are and mm-hmm. how unpredictable in a way they are when they go to cast their ballot. I mean, where does that leave you in terms of understanding them?
I think one of the things that really caught my party off guard this year is the northern and Midwestern working class white vote, which Barack Obama did very well with in previous elections. In fact, he's probably been, it's understated how well he did with that group of voters. But this year, they swung wildly toward the Republican Party. And I think that there's going to be a lot of folks in the Democratic Party who will be wanting to approach those voters who may have voted for Obama in 2012, but have become economically frustrated and disenchanted, have been for a long time, want something new, and swung toward Trump. And for the sake both of the Democratic Party as a strategist, and also because, you know, those people's voices need to be considered in the electorate, I think that there's going to be a lot of attempts to kind of understand and reach out to those people. The question is whether, if the distrust this year built up so much that those conversations are going to be difficult to have, that's yet to be seen. You know, 6 months from now, heck, 6 months ago, I would not be predicting where we're sitting right now. So 6 months from now, who knows? But my hope is that because I think those conversations are so important for our civic health and for my job, to be frank, I mean, I hope we can have those. But I think more than any time in our recent history, that's kind of a question mark looming out there.
That was Democratic political consultant Ben Anderstone. He's busy these days going to postmortems with pollsters and political consultants who are trying to figure out what happened this election. It's The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. You're listening to The Record. I'm Deborah Wong, sitting in for Bill Radke. We're live tweeting at KUOW. Can you heal yourself with the power of your brain? When Eric Vance was an 18-month-old baby, he came down with a serious illness, possibly Legionnaire's disease. His parents were Christian Scientists, and instead of taking him to the hospital, they brought in a healer and prayed for him. Their son miraculously recovered. Eric is now a science journalist and the author of the new book, Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. He wrote the book as he tried to answer questions he had about his own experiences with unexplained healing.
How did things that I saw, the healings I saw, not just from me, but in the community I lived in, how did those things happen? These people are not crazy. They're not stupid. They're acting logically, and they are getting better. So what's happening? It actually came into clarity when I started to come into clarity when I went to a brain science meeting a number of years ago, and I saw a talk on the placebo effect and how the placebo effect operates in the brain. And I looked at the speaker, and it was a name that I recognized as being another Christian Scientist, a former Christian Scientist who was in a very similar position to me. And a light went off in my head. It was just like, wow, you know, it's like a Catholic studying the brain state of guilt, you know, like it's like wow, what a perfect thing to study. And what they've learned, what scientists have learned, is that there's actually an entire pharmacy inside of our heads mm-hmm. that medicate us based on our expectation. Your brain is a prediction machine, and it makes predictions all day long. It's pretty much all your brain does. And your brain doesn't want to be wrong. It doesn't want those predictions to be incorrect. So if you're a little off, it will drop in drugs in order to make expectation meet reality. And that's what a placebo effect is. It's just your brain making up the difference. And it can be a very powerful thing.
Do placebos work the same for everybody, or is there a difference in our personalities?
The easy answer is no. For many decades, scientists have been trying to understand if there's a certain person out there, the certain placebo responders, kind of like the holy grail for people in this field. Is there someone who responds to placebos consistently more than other people? And it's been hard to find. Scientists have looked at race, they've looked at gender, they've looked at age, they've looked at personality types, hypnotizability, all kinds of different things. And it just hasn't worked out. Hypnotizability is a great example because that's something that doesn't change. It tends to stay the same throughout your life. Placebos, one day to the next, one person to the next, one drug to the next, it changes a lot. And a lot of that's because of the chemistry and now maybe even the genetics. And not only that, but it also varies from one condition to the next. Okay. And that's actually a better place to look for interesting science, because if you look at things like Parkinson's disease, chronic pain, depression, anxiety, even some autoimmune diseases and asthma, these things respond very well to placebos. Your mind and your expectation has a huge effect on these conditions. Other things like Alzheimer's disease or a tumor don't respond very well to placebos. And so what that tells me is there are rules. There are rules that can be followed. There are laws at work that we just don't understand fully yet.
Rules like what? What do you need to make a placebo work?
Well, so these are some of the things that scientists are trying to figure out. And let's take pain. In the case of pain, your brain actually has endogenous opioids. And we've heard a lot about opioids over the past few years and the effects that they can have on people. But you have opioids in your brain. You also have endocannabinoids, which are some of the same chemicals you see in marijuana. You have serotonin. You have dopamine. You have all these different chemicals. They can be very powerful drugs. And in the case of pain, if you take a pill and you expect that pill to take your pain away, and it's an inert pill, your brain can step in and release its own opioids to make the pain go away. If you expect it, I'll say if you expect it enough, then this can happen. And so that's a chemical reaction. That's something you can understand as a scientist. You can piece these things together. And there's certain conditions in which opioids are very useful, and others where it's not. Same with dopamine. Parkinson's is very useful to have extra dopamine floating around in your brain, but for obsessive compulsive disorder, it's not. And so these things, that's the rules that we're sort of piecing out, is which chemicals do we have access to and which ones are helpful for which conditions.
You write about a researcher who conducted a study in which she gave, I believe it was pain medication to patients, and then gradually took away those pain meds and gave them more and more placebos over the course of time, and found that people didn't really notice that their pain meds were going away and they were getting placebos because they looked the same and they assumed that they had those expectations that they were getting their pain meds. And I guess that's amazing to me. And it also might feel like, I think it might feel a little disappointing to people that they are being tricked into having the same response than if they were actually taking the medications. I mean, is there this sense of like, my gosh, what's wrong with my brain? I'm being tricked.
That's kind of a pessimistic way to look at it. I didn't think of you as a pessimist. it's absolutely, I get that. Her name is Luana Coloca, and she's an amazing researcher out of University of Maryland right now. And actually, that hasn't been published yet, so I'm still a little vague on the details until it gets fully published. But what she saw is, and it's a similar thing that we see in a lot of conditions, is that it's not so much that you don't need those drugs. Well, we're still figuring this out exactly how this works, but it looks like it's not so much that you don't need those drugs. It's that over time, your brain learns to regulate itself. It has its own store of drugs. It has its own homeostasis that it's trying to find, which is, you know, a level of no pain. And your brain sort of figures out where that spot is. And the drugs can you know, it can certainly help with immediate pain, but then over time it can help sort of ease you in your brain into the point where it can regulate itself. Because like I said, it has the drugs on hand. It's just a matter of trying to figure out. And there's a theory out there that a lot of chronic pain is related to your brain simply not knowing the right levels for its own self-medication and being a little off. And so you have residual pain.
So if it's true that the mind is a really powerful healer, and as you say, there's this pharmaceutical cabinet in our brains ready to go to respond to pain or injury, why do we need to spend so much money on doctors? I mean, why do we need to take all these pharmaceuticals? Is there a different way?
You know, it's different for everybody, and there's a balance in our lives. And there are, you know, take cancer. If belief has a powerful effect on the symptoms of cancer, you know, the pain, the nausea, and the symptoms of treatment as well, you know, depression, like there can be a lot that belief, placebos, alternative medicine, you know, these things can be very helpful for people. But for the actual tumor themselves, all indications are that they don't. We don't have much access to tools to remove a tumor from ourselves. We need to understand the limits, the possibilities, and the limits of our own brains. And in the case of cancer, you know, there's a limit. And we need to go to the doctor, you know, for those things where our brains are limited. But where there are possibilities, and people say, oh, should we be prescribing placebos? Well, we already do. You know, 70% of doctors say they occasionally prescribe placebos, and for those that don't, I mean, those of us who are patients, we go to alternative medicine. We try different supplements that clearly are not doing anything beyond triggering the placebo effect. But we do it anyway. And this is how, and I do it. I take these sort of fizzy drink supplement things that, because, and the fizziness, I swear the fizziness is what does it for me. I love a fizzy drink, and I know it feels like it's doing something. It's that feeling. And I know I'm tricking myself, but the science actually shows that even if you know it's happening, even if you know it might be a placebo, it can still work. And that's because a lot of this is unconscious. And I take like raw garlic, another one that I do, and it's, boy, it just, you know, it's a very unpleasant experience, but it feels like it's doing something to you. And so we can tap into these things within reason, and I lay out some guidelines in the book, but within reason we can tap into these things, at the same time knowing that for other conditions, a conventional doctor is really the way to go.
Eric Vance is a science writer for Nature, The New York Times, National Geographic, and others. His new book is Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. You can hear Eric Vance speak tonight at Town Hall at 7:30. This is The Record. I'm Deborah Wong. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray has vowed that Seattle will remain a so-called sanctuary city for undocumented immigrants, even if it means losing federal dollars. That's something President-elect Trump threatened when he was on the campaign trail. Seattle could also find itself at odds with the federal government over police reform, environmental protections, and transportation policy. Mayor Ed Murray talked with KUOW's Bill Radke about how things might change for this liberal city working alongside a conservative federal government. First, he explained what it means for Seattle to be a sanctuary city.
We offer services to anyone who is in this city. And we do not use our police force to identify people based on whether they have documents or don't have documents. The best example I can give you is the day after the election. I was in an eighth grade classroom in the Seattle Public Schools. Most of the kids were Latino, and some of them were actually undocumented. So what we're not going to do is to tell those young people, we're going to let the feds come and pull you out of your community where you've spent your whole life living and send you to a place you've never been.
So the city won't cooperate. Does that mean that can't happen?
Well, the federal government has the ability to come in if they want to and start removing people, but we, the city, are not going to participate in that. Now, again, you need to think through how they do that. They'd have to either create a federal police force on immigration, which this nation has never done before. They'd have to nationalize our police force or change the law that allows us to have the freedom as a city to cooperate or not cooperate. So it's a significant series of moves that they would have to make before they got to that place.
Some Americans are saying these undocumented immigrants are cutting ahead in line in front of people who are waiting to get into this country legally. Why is being a sanctuary city so important to you?
You know, the people who are undocumented in this city and really in this state are here because they're doing jobs that Americans usually won't do. I think about Eastern Washington and our agricultural business. And they're also paying taxes, and they're here helping to build our economy. So I think that's perhaps the way we should look at this. And then again, you have to look at the moral argument. They're here doing jobs we won't do. They're paying taxes. Their kids are going to our schools, have never lived in another country except this country. Are we really going to rip those families apart or rip them out of this city? I don't think that makes good sense economically, and it doesn't make good sense morally.
You said it's hard to say how much federal funding Seattle could lose over the sanctuary city issue. How would we make up lost federal money?
Well, obviously, again, the federal government, a president needs to go through Congress, and it would be more than Seattle that would be hit. So that's not a given. So I think we don't need to get too far ahead of ourselves. Finally, this is a city that again and again has shown a willingness to step up and replace federal money. You have to remember, the amount of cuts that have happened to federal programs over the last few decades is significant. We're not talking anymore about, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. We're talking tens of millions that we might lose. We'd look at revenue in our own city. We'd look at prioritizing what we need to do. I just hope that there are enough people in the United States Senate who also have cities in their states who will say this is just a crazy idea.
What do you say to the argument that cities and counties and regions are just going to have to fund their own priorities instead of having it come from the federal level?
Well, we fund most of our own priorities. I mean, $85 million is roughly what we get a year in various programs out of a budget, you know, of several billion dollars. So the federal government is a player, and we appreciate them as partners. It's helpful. But this is a city that has stepped up five times in the last 2 years and voted for new revenue. So I think we've already shown that we're the ones carrying most of the water when it comes to taxes, not the federal government.
You said that Seattle needs help from the federal government to solve the homelessness crisis that you've declared. How likely is that funding under a Trump administration and Republican Congress?
So if you remember that the homeless crisis is not a Seattle crisis, but a national crisis, and that there's a housing affordability crisis in every county in the United States, this administration doesn't address that issue. You know, homelessness won't get bad just in Seattle. It will get bad in every part of this country. So again, it's really a decision about what kind of America we want to have. And the idea that somehow Seattle has special problems or special needs, it's just not the case.
If that federal money is not coming through, will you put a homelessness levy in place to raise the money here?
It's certainly something I said we would entertain, but it also begs a question. What will our suburban cities that are struggling with homelessness do? What will the city of Olympia that's struggling with homelessness do? So again, I don't think it's just how Seattle answers the question. It's how local governments in the state as a whole answers the question.
Could we talk about the way the people of Seattle feel for a moment? Because as you know, there's been so much talk from some people who feel worried and scared and angry around a Trump presidency. Other people saying that that's overblown or it's sour grapes. What are you feeling and hearing? And what do you want your citizens to feel?
Well, you know, this is a city that's very concerned. And there are people who live in this city who are scared. I'm very concerned as a city that's in the most trade-dependent state in the union about our international relations. I'm very concerned that people who have in the past proposed registration for Muslims are being considered for cabinet positions. We have good reason to be concerned when you look at the language that was used by the president-elect and some of the people he is considering to put in government. The thing we can do is to remember that this is a federal system, which means power does not rest simply at the national level, and we at the local level need to act on our progressive policies. I think that's how we change the national dialogue, is by our ability to come together and move a progressive agenda forward at the local level.
That was Seattle Mayor Ed Murray talking with KUOW's Bill Radke about the possible effects of a Trump administration on the city. What about the possible effects of a Trump administration on Washington state companies? John Talton is the Seattle Times economics columnist, and he's been thinking about that question. Hi, John.
Hi, Deb.
Well, first of all, we should say we just don't, you know, a lot of this is theoretical. We don't know what campaign promises the president-elect will carry out, but if he does, let's talk first about Boeing. Trump pledged to confront China on the trade deficit. What might that mean for Boeing?
It would be really bad for Boeing. As a candidate, Trump has said he wants to slap a 45% tariff on China, and China will not sit idly by. The big problem is China is one of Boeing's biggest customers, if not the biggest customer going forward. And this could easily cost Boeing huge orders with China that would go to Airbus. And then China wants to launch its own commercial aircraft in the future. And so this would be devastating to the region.
Do we have any sense of how Boeing executives are thinking about this right now?
Well, I talked to Ray Conner, the president of Commercial Airlines, before the election, and he was pushing back against Trump's statement that Boeing was going to send American jobs to China. He absolutely said that was wrong. That was not true. Boeing has set up a finishing center in China for airplanes that are built here. They're then flown to China where they're finished with interiors and things like that. So Boeing is in a tough situation like every corporation. They don't want to choose sides in an election, but they have certainly pushed back against the narrative that American Boeing jobs are going to go to China.
Well, let's talk about another sector, agriculture, because I know we also do sell a lot of agricultural products to China as well.
Agriculture is an issue partly because we have worked so hard to open doors in China to Washington tree fruits and other agriculture. And so, too, can play the game. Mm-hmm. If we slap tariffs on China, China can slap tariffs on American products, and agricultural goods are always vulnerable because a foreign government can always pull out a hygiene law or a safety law and say that these apples suddenly don't meet it. It may not be true. It probably isn't true, but it's a very familiar form of protectionism.
And are farmers nervous right now about what might happen under a Trump administration?
Well, I don't know if the nervousness has fully kicked in, considering that the agricultural counties went for Trump in a big way.
I guess the question of tariffs and the potential of a trade war makes you wonder. I mean, was this sort of, you know, here's a man who talks about the art of the deal. Could this just be a negotiating posture? Could just this be the sort of the nuclear option that will never unfold?
It could be. And among the many stream of consciousness things he said, well, this is just to start a negotiation. We need to bear in mind that China's president, Xi Jinping, is also a nationalist, and so he doesn't want to appear to be pushed around. Political scientists say that presidents do carry out about 75 or 80% of their campaign promises, and Trump's base is going to try to hold him to it, so he'll be in a pickle.
I want to talk about a little bit about Amazon. And CEO Jeff Bezos made an enemy in Trump during the campaign, partly because Bezos owns the Washington Post, and Trump took offense at a lot of what was written in the Washington Post by journalists there. How will a Trump administration likely affect Amazon and Jeff Bezos?
This is another one of Seattle's vulnerabilities. If Amazon sneezes, Seattle catches pneumonia because so many jobs have been created here, so many transformative effects on the economy. And Trump at one point said that he wanted to do an antitrust investigation on Bezos. And that wouldn't just stop at the Washington Post. Now, is this just overnight tweeting by the president-elect that'll never come to anything? We don't know. But this is a lack of continuity that we've never seen before in an incoming administration, in the promises a candidate has made. And so we're rightly nervous.
Yeah. So we've talked about the threats of a Trump administration to the local and regional economy. What are the opportunities, or are there opportunities that Washington State could actually benefit from a Trump administration?
The rich people are going to get a big tax break, and I suppose they'll like that. Inequality will widen, of course. Washington is a big military state, and it could benefit from increased military spending by a Trump administration, which he's promised to do. That may run up against some headwinds from a Republican Congress that's worried about debt and deficits, but those are two areas that one might call opportunities.
Okay. Well, we are going to keep an eye on this, and we will keep in touch with you to see how many of these campaign promises actually do come to fruition. John Talton from the Seattle Times, thanks so much.
Thanks, Deb.
And that's our show for today. I'm Deborah Wong. Bill Radke is back tomorrow. Thank you for joining us on The Record.